Hello, Anthony Fennell here, and welcome to Future Tense. There are some connections in life that are easy to grasp. Rum and raisins, for instance, or politicians and power, beaches and holidays, no-brainers. But there are some that don't come all that easily, to most of us, that is. They need a bit of explanation, a bit of teasing out. Let me give you an example. Data and art. I know what many of you are thinking. Art, of course, is creative and expressive and free-flowing. And data, well, data is mathematical and mechanical. But crazy as it may seem, there are those among us who refuse to see the two as polar opposites. In fact, they're busy proving that in the right hands, data can be artistic. Dr. Geo Homsey is a computer and software architect with a PhD in computational biology, and he's long been fascinated by data. He's also an artist.
I think we're already seeing a much more vigorous and active connection between the sciences and the arts, especially vis-a-vis the modern maker movement of the last, 10 to 15 years, where as the explosion of information available to people via the internet has progressed, so too they have access to the ability to form communities and share information about engineering and art practice in a way that's never before been possible. And so I think you see naturally a vigorous cross-disciplinary community that's geographically dispersed but is united by this concept of using arts and technology to make an impact.
And make an impact, Dr. Homsey and his team certainly did, with the design for a mechanical data-generating sculpture called the Organograph, a 75-foot-tall metal and glass structure which is to be built in downtown San Jose, California. It's just won the San Jose International Climate Clock Competition, and there's a video to be found on our website. Now, we'll come back to the Organograph shortly, but I don't want to jump too far ahead. You see, Geo Homsey was in Australia recently as part of an interesting initiative called Ecology, Making Sense of Data, a project that's all about bringing artists, scientists and urban developers together to create what they call data-driven public artworks. One of those leading the project is Vicky Sowry from ANAT, the Australian Network for Art and Technology. And like Dr. Homsey, she sees the distinction between science and art as a recent but now outdated construct.
I mean, you look back in the Renaissance era and that distinction wasn't there. You could have someone who now would be called a polymath, they would be proficient in languages and they'd be a mathematician and they would also be a sculptor. I expect that in some way the Industrial Revolution and capitalism had some part to play in that separation. I think people now realising the kind of complex situations we're facing culturally and socially and every other way require complex solutions. You can't just have a single response from a single sector. And so we're finding increasingly that certainly scientists are much more interested and open to working with creatives in their work and vice versa. Imagine living alongside an artwork that lives and breathes. It feeds back your behaviours to you on a daily basis. It encourages you to change, it encourages you to be more sustainable, it encourages you to use resources better, but at the same time provides an incredibly engaging and evocative and playful way of engaging with your local environment. That's what we're hoping Ecology will do. As part of our research, it became clear that there's a lot of data, obviously increasing amounts of data being generated. Alongside that, there is a commitment to open data, particularly in local governments and different tiers of government. I think increasingly industry and the corporate sector is also understanding that there's value in releasing their data. Alongside that, there are a number of tools, and these have been around for quite some time, data aggregation and publishing tools. So we had been kind of feeling the temperature internationally, and it became clear that artists increasingly were working with data just as a potter would work with clay, moulding it and transforming it and teasing it and, I guess, critiquing it and really pummeling it in some ways. We also became aware that most of the engagement of artists with data was screen-based, and we felt we really wanted to break the data out of the screen space and, I guess, engage other sense modalities, so working with sound and light and natural materials, smell, which often, once you have a frame around something, it's very easy to be separate from it, whereas when you're engaging with other modalities, it's a much more subconscious engagement. So that's where it came from. We're basically wanting to get artists to work with data as a medium to create some really innovative and playful but serious artworks which develop a relationship with the communities in which they reside. The idea with these artworks is that they're fed by real-time data. The provenance of the data is local, and local communities have a direct link to the artwork, and their actions are directly feeding the artworks. By changing their actions, they change the artwork, and so there's this feedback loop that's established between the artworks and the communities, which I think makes for a much stronger relationship between art and how it can impact on communities.
Vicky Sowry from ANAT, the Australian Network for Art and Technology. And now for some examples of public art that's science-based and data-rich. And let's head back to the Organograph.
The Organograph is a proposed public art installation for San Jose, California. Moving slowly along a boulevard within the Diridon Station redevelopment area, the sculpture will be both civic beacon and a topic of public discussion and awareness of climate change for the next 100 years.
Geo Holmesy, the Organograph you've described as a participatory sculpture, what do we mean by that exactly? Participatory in what way?
It's basically a moving, living building, which is it's at once an architectural form, a sculptural form, a park, and a science museum in all in one. It's a moving building with five layers that's a giant, organically inspired flower-shaped clock that visitors can go up inside and observe the mechanisms of climate change in action and thereby understand more about climate change and the environment they live in.
Now, it's a sculpture. It's a park, as you said. It's also about telling a story, isn't it? It gets people involved in the issue of climate change by taking them almost through a story, using technology to bring them through a story. Is that correct?
Yes. It seeks to elucidate the processes that are at work in climate change. And we like to think of the structure itself, the organograph structure itself, as the storyteller. And what it's doing is modeling the Earth's carbon cycle and the process of disturbance of that carbon cycle in a visible form, a tangible form. And what it does is it moves through the landscape along a pair of tracks and basically leaves a living history behind it in modeled carbon spheres forming a pathway and color-coded plants forming a garden so that you can see the past history of Earth's average temperature as it relates to the amount of carbon that's been deposited in the atmosphere. It's a story that we think needs to be told and understood. In the U.S., we have a strong contingent of climate change skeptics. And as you know, these processes are invisible, they're subtle, and they're long-term. So it takes millions of people and decades of time to see any tangible effects of our effect on the climate. So what we seek to do with this sculptural process model is to compress the scale to a tangible scale and compress the time to a viscerally palpable period of time, and also to render visible the invisible chemicals that we're talking about in the atmosphere.
The idea of, I guess, non-static art, a lot of us are used to art that has a theme, public art that has a theme, but public art that is very static. Is there a move toward art, public art that engages with you, that isn't just there to be seen? It actually moves, it operates, it involves some kind of dynamism.
I can't claim that we have the original claim on dynamic public art. There's a long history of public art that's dynamic and interacts with people and the environment in various ways. I think one of the distinguishing characteristics of this is its use of organic media as a sort of a display technology, if you will, using plants to show what has gone before, and also that this is really part sculpture and part architecture and part science museum, if you will. There will be tags situated throughout the sculpture that people can scan with their phone or their iPad or whatever and discover on subsequent visits, subsequently more detail about what they're looking at and hopefully deepen their understanding and their appreciation of it over time. So it's partially a representational work and partially a sculptural work.
Artist and scientist Geo Holmesy. And I should have mentioned up front that his co-creators on the Organograph installation are Chico McMurtry and Bill Washabar. You're with Future Tense, the edge of change, new ideas, new approaches, new technologies. Today we're looking at creative combinations of data, art and science in the public space. And now let's head to the UK and Usman Haque.
Another Life is a permanent public space interactive installation. It's in Bradford in the north of England. And essentially what it is a sort of park that's full of sensors and lasers and fountains and lights and cameras and all these sorts of things, weather station, where what I've done is I've tried to create a system where all these things will respond to people in real time in very different ways. So that on different days, at different times of the day, if you're walking through the park, different things might happen. The fountains might follow you, or they might avoid you. The lasers might come on and create little creatures on the ground that are sort of bouncing between you and your fellow pedestrians. Or in other instances, perhaps somebody's actually plugged in their music player and the whole place is responding to the music system in color and fountains and what have you. Really what Another Life is about is sort of creating a large-scale interactive artwork that is a little bit different so that the people who are living in the city and experiencing it every day can actually see different things from time to time. And then actually to take ownership of it themselves and reconfigure it in ways that probably I can't even imagine.
And the benefits in that form of art, in using senses as part of an art form like that, a public art form?
For me, the interesting thing is to develop something that's dynamic, that is responding in real time to people. But more importantly, to develop something where the people can actually change the way it responds to them, if you see what I mean. So it's not just about making a light switch, which switches on a bunch of colored patterns when I walk past it, and it does the same thing every single time I walk past it, or to use the analogy, flick the switch. But instead, where normal people, that's sort of just members of the public, can somehow rewire it, rewire the installation so that sometimes the fountains respond to them, other times it's the lights that respond to them. Sometimes the fountains are responding to the weather station, the direction of the wind, and where they can actually take that decision of what their park is doing, rather than me as an artist simply imposing my fixed program on what it's going to do.
In many ways, using technology, modern technology in this way, to create interactive art is quite a new field, isn't it? We're only really just beginning to understand its uses, how we can do that.
Well, I think there's a sort of interesting relationship between the sort of social aspect of technology and art and design in general. And in a sense, we've seen this coming now for several decades. You know, you could even point at performance art in the 40s and 50s and 60s that was technology-based and it was pointing towards the kinds of things we're seeing now. And what that process has always been about is trying to put more power back into the what was originally an audience member, if you like, but which now you can kind of see as being the performer, that sort of members of the public can become the performers, can become part of the artwork somehow.
So that's empowering in a sense, isn't it, for a member of the public?
That's my hope. I mean, that is actually why this kind of work interests me, because I'm almost obsessed, I suppose, with what I call the structures of participation. You know, how to actually get people involved and engaged, and in a sense for them to take ownership of something. Because again, especially in the field of public art, there is this sort of history of the artist coming in, plopping something in a plaza, and then going off to work in some other city. And I'd like to look more at ways that when there is a sort of public art project, that the people who have to live with it are actually able to have some ongoing effect on what it's doing.
Now, it's one thing to design for interactivity. It's another thing for people to actually take up that challenge, to take up that opportunity. So with Another Life, are they taking up that opportunity? Are they being playful with the installation itself.
Another Life only opened recently, so we haven't had a chance really to look at all the different ways people are interacting with it, but certainly I can tell you that there's lots of people jumping into the fountains and trying to sort of guess how it is exactly that the fountains are going to respond to them this time. And that's kind of interesting because Bradford's not exactly known for being a warm city.
So where are we at? Well, we've looked at the use of data with a heavy dose of engineering to generate a moving art installation come environmental timeline. And of course, we've just heard about Usman Haque's data and sensor-laden park, which adjusts itself to human interaction. But in Melbourne, there's a project underway that's all about fitting the outside of buildings with a sort of skin that's woven with electrically activated discs. Discs that then change colour according to the building's energy usage. It's about art, and it's about environmental sustainability. It's called the Dot Blush Project. And to tell us more about it, here's Jodie Newcombe from Carbon Arts, a body which commissions works of art with the climate change message, and also electronic artist Pierre Prosky.
So the idea is to sort of invest a certain emotion into the architecture so that when a building's performing well, performing efficiently energy-wise, it blushes with pleasure.
And blushes in what sense? The external skin of the building actually changes to give some sort of indication to people about the energy usage. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So the facade of the building will have a number of dots or spheres, or circles rather, and they will illuminate when the building blushes, so to speak. If you look at a lot of technical and scientific instrumentation, whenever you're exceeding the limit, you go into the red. But this is more the inverse of that, where when the building goes red, it's a happy building, it's blushing with pleasure.
So the more energy efficient a building is, the more red it will be, the more red spots will appear on the external side of the building.
Exactly.
Jodie, you work for an organisation called Carbon Arts, which works with the creative sector to raise awareness around climate change issues. What's your interest in this project? Why are you on board?
The project is, part of a philosophy that we need to make visible the green infrastructure that we're developing in cities around the country, and to be proud of that. So it brings to the fore the sorts of technologies that are typically hidden. So like, you know, tri-generation plant or solar panels on the roof of a building aren't typically there for the passers-by to see. And also, I suppose another aspect of our interest in this project is the idea of art as a reward. So for people within the building who are taking lots of measures to reduce their energy use, the facade of the building will actually be a kind of real-time feedback loop that will provide them with some sort of playful interaction in their efforts.
So people can be proud of the fact that their building lights up with these red spots, and that indicates to others that they're doing the right thing by energy efficiency.
Exactly.
Pierre, there's an element of fun to this project, isn't there? How important is that in motivating people to reduce their energy consumption?
I think that was critical in devising sort of the project, that I really wanted to emphasise something that was playful and not punitive, because there are so many other sort of energy monitoring devices that tend to remind us when we're using an excess. They don't always remind us when we're using less than a certain amount. So, and I just think in general, people tend to respond much better to a sort of positive reinforcement rather than some kind of punishment or shameful reminder. So I think when the building blushes, there is a certain embarrassment there, and it's maybe an embarrassment for actually using less energy for once. I think that's sort of it's a pleasurable embarrassment.
Well, Jodie Newcombe, the value of creating a spectacle with a project like this, I mean, how important is that for a community? Because we're not just talking about trying to change the behaviour of the people in one particular building or a group of buildings, are we?
No, that's right. And I think that's the power of public art and art that is a spectacle, is to create a platform for conversation. And if by being aware of the messages that this artwork will be displaying, people can actually start talking about, well, what does energy efficiency mean, and, you know, how many buildings in the city are performing to the same level as this one? Where are we on our way to a target that, say, the city of Melbourne is looking to achieve in terms of carbon neutrality? What role does the commercial building sector play in that target? And, you know, what kinds of technologies are getting us there? So I think it's a really fantastic starting point for the citizens of a city to start to understand the progress that's being made. And it's a very positive story. And I think a lot of the media around climate change and the progress that Australia needs to make in an international sense is negative. And it's a very, you know, it's sort of portrayed as is difficult and expensive and so forth. But what I think is sort of missing is this understanding that there actually is a lot of progress and a lot of building managers and big businesses are moving ahead and finding a lot of financial benefit from introducing energy efficiency and introducing renewable energy, both within buildings and at a precinct scale.
Pierre Porosky, this project is planned to launch next year. What stage are you at the moment?
Currently we're at the research and development stage, so I'll be working with an engineer whose name is Jason Bond. There are two streams in the actual development of the project, one of them which may involve a paint which changes colour, and the other one will probably involve lighting technology, most likely in the form of LEDs. So we're in the research and development phase at the moment, moving on to an early prototype towards the middle to latter half of this year.
Jodie Newcombe and Pierre Porosky, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you
very much.
Now, there is a connection between Jodie Newcombe's Carbon Arts organisation and Vicky Sowry's Australian Network for Art and Technology, ANAT. Both are partners in the Ecology Project, which I mentioned right at the beginning of the programme. And there is another partner, a corporate partner, because to do anything adventurous with art, of course, it helps to have either a patron or a corporation on board with serious money and resources.
Lendlease's founder, Dick Dusseldorf, dreamt of an organisation that would be measured not just on its financial returns, but on its positive contribution to the environment and to society.
The giant construction company, Lendlease, is in talks with the Ecology team about incorporating a significant data-driven public artwork into its Victoria Harbour Urban Renewal Project in the heart of Melbourne. So what's their interest, you might ask? Well, Claire Johnston is the project director for Victoria Harbour.
Sustainability is one of those key driving forces for mixed-use urban renewal projects, of which Victoria Harbour is one. And part of a sustainability agenda is about cultural consideration and how you manifest that. And for us, the arts program now is a good marriage of the sustainability story in a cultural context, that being art. And it's very easy to determine a building's performance and to manage it by technology and data, but it's not always as easy to educate the public about what's going on and how that building, for example, is helping to reduce a carbon footprint or to contribute positively to the environment. And so this particular piece of sort of art project, we believe it will help to communicate that story in a very physical way about the sustainability features or, you know, benefits of a space and a place, and art will be the vehicle for that.
And the exact form of that initiative is still being discussed, is that correct?
That's right. And, you know, as with everything that is sort of has art or culture associated with it is somewhat subjective and must be delivered in its context. And so as we're evolving the Victoria Harbour Master Plan, we're also evolving what the appropriate art response to that will be. And we see that ecology will be a really important part of that, telling that sustainability story in a cultural context.
Now, we're used to thinking about organisations like Lendlease as block builders, if you like, as companies that pour concrete, that build structures. We don't necessarily think of them in an artistic way, do we?
I suppose I do, but that's because I've been around for 17 years. But it's clearly a common response that people would see organisations like Lendlease as having a traditional view of the construction process. It is quite true, however, that, you know, when you're delivering urban renewal master plan communities such as Lendlease is, that you can't just build a building and leave. There's a real legacy obligation in these sort of mixed-use brownfield renewal sites, which Lendlease take very seriously. And so that starts at a master plan level, but then it has to be sort of delivered throughout a project. So for our precinct at Victoria Harbour, we're delivering 350,000 square metres of commercial space and another 280,000 of residential space. So we're big deliverers of city extensions, and we're really only 50% of the way through it. So in order to deliver a true civic experience and something that combines with the existing fabric of a city, you have to respond to that. And art and activities and community considerations are fundamental to that.
And the way in which the Data Ecology Initiative is talking involves using data as a form of art that's perhaps much more interactive and engaging than traditional forms of art. Is that your view?
Absolutely. And I think that art has to respond to the community, and it has to be there for the community and used by and understood by the community. And if you look at the evolution of people's interest in art and public realm and civic pieces, it's certainly growing in terms of people's desire to be interactive and participative with the elements of things in the public realm, such as art. And so what we really see as the opportunity is to be telling sustainability stories in a physical way using data. And we don't, as I said, we don't know what form that will take, but the connection and the educative responsibility of art is certainly increasing.
Increasingly, you know, because we live in this digital era, data is all around us. You know, we're constantly tracking and calculating and tabulating the way people live their lives. And I think it's really crucial and critical that artists are involved in interpreting this and critiquing it for other people. I think it's almost like we're totally surrounded by this invisible network that's just tracking what we do and who we are and how we live our lives. And so being able to get access to that is very empowering, and being able to turn it almost on its head in ways that people who were responsible for the original collection of the data couldn't possibly have dreamed of. But what it does is it shows us in a different way who we are and how we're living and what we can do to change some of the behaviours that perhaps are less productive and, you know, really depleting the sorts of resources that we take for granted.
Vicky Sowry from the Australian Network for Art and Technology. And before her, Claire Johnston from the construction company Lendlease. Also on today's program, artist and scientist Geo Holmesy, fellow artist Pierre Prosky, Jodie Newcomb from Carbon Arts, and Usman Haque, director of the UK-based company Haque Design and Research.